24. Song of the Central Pier. When the lights went out, Yamazaki fumbled in the dark for his bag. Finding it, he felt through it for his flashlight. In the white beam, Skinner slept, slack-jawed beneath the blankets and a ragged sleeping bag. Yamazaki searched the several shelves above the table edge, small glass jars of spices, identical jars containing steel screws, an ancient bakelite telephone reminding him of the origin of the verb to dial, rolls of many different kinds and colors of adhesive tape, twists of heavy copper wire, pieces of what he took to be saltwater tackle, and finally, a bundle of dusty candle stubs secured with a rotting rubber band. Selecting the longest of these, he found a lighter beside the green camp stove. Standing the candle upright on a white saucer, he lit it. The flame fluttered and went out. Flashlight in hand, he moved to the window and tugged it more tightly into its deep, circular frame. Now the candle stayed lit, though the flame pulsed and swelled in drafts he could never hope to locate. Returning to the window, he looked out. The darkened bridge was invisible. Rain was driving almost horizontally against the window, tiny droplets reaching his face through cracks in the glass and corroded segments of the supporting lead. It occurred to him that Skinner's room might be made to function as a camera obscura. If the church window's tiny central bullseye pane were removed and the other panes covered, an inverted image would be cast on the opposite wall. Yamazaki knew that the central pier, the bridge's center anchorage, had once qualified as one of the world's largest pinhole cameras. In the structure's pitch-black interior, light shining in through a single tiny hole had projected a huge image of the underside of the lower deck, the nearest tower, and the surrounding bay. Now, the heart of the anchorage housed some uncounted number of the bridge's more secretive inhabitants, and Skinner had advised him against attempting to go there.
"Nothing like those Mansons out in the bushes on Treasure Scooter, but you don't want to bother 'em anyway. Okay people, but they just aren't looking for anybody to drop in, know what I mean?"
Yamazaki crossed to the smooth curve of cable that interrupted the room's floor. Only an oval segment of it was visible, like some mathematical formula barely breaking a topological surface in a computer representation. He bent to touch it, the visible segment polished by other hands. Each of the 37 cables containing 472 wires had withstood, and withstood now, a force of some million pounds. Yamazaki felt something, some message of vast, obscure moment, shiver up through the relic-smooth dorsal hump. The storm, surely. The bridge itself was capable of considerable mobility. It expanded and contracted with heat and cold. The great steel teeth of the piers were sunk into bedrock beneath the bay mud, bedrock that had scarcely moved, even in the Little Grande. Godzilla. Yamazaki shivered, recalling television images of Tokyo's fall. He had been in Paris with his parents. Now a new city rose there, its buildings grown, literally, floor by floor. The candlelight showed him Skinner's little television, forgotten on the floor. Taking it to the table, he sat on the stool and examined it. There was no visible damage to the screen. It had simply come away from its frame on a short length of multicolored ribbon. He folded the ribbon into the frame and pressed with his thumbs on either side of the screen. It popped back into place, but would it still function? He bent to examine the tiny controls. On. Lime and purple diagonals chased themselves across the screen, then faded, revealing some Steadicam fragment, the NHK logo displayed in the lower left corner. Heir apparent to the Harwood Levine public relations and advertising fortune, departed San Francisco this afternoon after a rumored stay of several days, declining comment on the purpose of his visit. A long face, horse-like yet handsome, above a raincoat's upturned collar. A large white smile. Accompanying him, mid-distance shot down an airport corridor, the slender, dark-haired woman wrapped in something luxurious and black, silver gleaming at the heels of her shining boots, was Maria Paz, the Padanian media personality daughter of film director Carlo Paz. The woman, who looked unhappy, vanished, to be replaced by infrared footage from New Zealand, as Japanese peacekeeping forces in armored vehicles advanced on a rural airport. Losses attributed to the outlawed South Island Liberation Front, while in Wellington, Yamazaki attempted to change the channel, but the screen only strobed its lime and purple, then framed a portrait of Shapley, a BBC docudrama. Calm, serious, mildly hypnotic. After two more unsuccessful attempts at locating another channel, Yamazaki let the British voiceover blot out the wind, the groaning of the cables, the creaking of the plywood walls. He focused his attention on the familiar story, its outcome fixed, comforting, if only in its certainty. James Delmore Shapley had come to the attention of the AIDS industry in the early months of the new century. He was 31 years old, a prostitute, and had been HIV positive for 12 years. At the time of his discovery by Dr. Kim Kutnick of Atlanta, Georgia, Shapley was serving a 250-day prison term for soliciting. His status as HIV positive, which would automatically have warranted more serious charges, had apparently been glitched. Kutnick, a researcher with the Sharman Group, an American subsidiary of Shibata Pharmaceuticals, was sifting prison medical data in search of individuals who had been HIV positive for a decade or more, were asymptomatic, and had entirely normal, or as in Shapley's case, above the norm, T-cell counts. One of the Sharman Group's research initiatives centered around the possibility of isolating mutant strains of HIV. Arguing that viruses obey the laws of natural selection, several Sharman biologists had proposed that the HIV virus, in its then-current genetic format, was excessively lethal. Allowed to range unchecked, argued the Sharman team, a virus demonstrating 100% lethality must eventually bring out the extinction of the host organism. Other Sharman researchers countered by citing the long incubation period as contributing to the survival of the host population. As the BBC writers were careful to make clear, the idea of locating non-pathogenic strains of HIV with a view of overpowering and neutralizing lethal strains had been put forward almost a decade earlier, though the ethical implications of experimentation with human subjects had impeded research. The core observation of the Sharman researchers dated from this earlier work. The virus wishes to survive and cannot if it kills its host. The Sharman team, of which Dr. Kutnick was a part, intended to inject HIV-positive patients with blood extracted from individuals they believed to be infected with non-pathogenic strains of the virus. It was possible, they believed, that the non-pathogenic strain would overpower the lethal strain. Kim Kutnick was one of seven researchers given the task of locating HIV-positive individuals who might be harboring a non-pathogenic strain. She elected to begin her search through a sector of data concerned with current inmates of state prisons who were, A, in apparent good health, and B, had tested HIV positive at least a decade before. Her initial search turned up 66 possibles, among them J.D. Shapley. Yamazaki watched as Kutnick, played by a young British actress, recalled from a patio in Rio her first meeting with Shapley. I'd been struck by the fact that his T-cell count that day was over 1,200, and that his responses to the questionnaire seemed to indicate that safe sex, as we thought of it then, was, well, not exactly a priority. He was a very open, very outgoing, really a very innocent character, and when I asked him, there in the prison visiting room, about oral sex, he actually blushed. Then he laughed and said, well, he said he sucked cock like it was going out of style. The actress, Kutnick, looked as though she were about to blush herself. Of course, she said, in those days we didn't really understand the disease's exact vectors of infection, because, grotesque as it now seems, there had been no real research into the precise modes of transmission. Yamazaki cut the set off. Dr. Kutnick would arrange Shapley's release from prison as an AIDS research volunteer under federal law.
The Sharman Group's project would be hindered by fundamentalist Christians objecting to the injection of HIV-tainted blood into the systems of terminally ill AIDS patients. As the project foundered, Kutnick would uncover clinical data suggesting that unprotected sex with Shapley had apparently reversed the symptoms of several of her patients. There would be Kutnick's impassioned resignation, the flight to Brazil with the baffled Shapley, lavish funding against a backdrop of impending civil war, and what could only be described as an extremely pragmatic climate for research. But it was such a sad story. Better to sit here by candlelight, elbows on the edge of Skinner's table, listening for the song of the central pier.